Hello, I'm Josh Barrow, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and I'm here with Steve Malanga, author of Shakedown, The Continuing Conspiracy Against the American Taxpayer, also a senior editor at City Journal. Steve, your book is about the conspiracy against the American taxpayer perpetuated by what you call a big government coalition. Can you talk about who this coalition is and how they came to be?
Sure. I basically classify them as the alliance of public sector unions and social advocacy groups, all of whom I call the self-interested left. Self-interested because they always have an interest in bigger government, not because necessarily bigger government does things better, more effectively, not necessarily because they're touting programs that work, but because it's always in their interest to see government grow. It's in their self-interest. This coalition emerged really in two distinct ways. One is the social advocacy groups came out of the war on poverty. We had an idea in the 1960s that we were going to address poverty, and it was a naive but hopeful idea that if we spent enough money, we could make a serious dent in it. The framers of the war on poverty in Washington didn't quite understand how to do this, and so one thing they came up with was sending billions and tens of billions of dollars to local community groups where they would spend this money on things like activism, kind of vague programs. What the war on poverty did do was create thousands, maybe tens of thousands of government-funded groups who, of course, had an interest in making sure that the funding kept on because it was essential to their sort of life. And so they became very active in politics. And we began to see increasingly, particularly in the 80s and the 90s, people in this coalition came to dominate legislatures in places like Sacramento and in Albany and in Trenton, and also city halls in places like New Jersey, city halls in places like New York City and Los Angeles and Chicago. The other part of the coalition is a group of public sector unions who began really getting the power to unionize and to collectively bargain in the late 1950s from politicians who saw them as potential political allies, starting really with Mayor Wagner here in New York City, who wanted them as allies in his battle against Tammany Hall, the political club, the political machine. And quickly, there was a domino effect around the country, and other politicians began granting them the right in states and in cities, and they quickly became very expert in electing their own bosses and also in negotiating not just salary and wage concessions that piled up over time, became extremely expensive, but also in negotiating changes to government, for instance, to arbitration rules in contract negotiations that were very subtle but were in their favor, in which many people in the press and most taxpayers didn't really understand in terms of the implications. So together over time, and it's been a long process, these groups have slowly gathered an awful lot of power that began really in state capitals and city halls, since some of these states like California, New York are quite big. The resources that they've gathered are enormous in these places.
What's been the effect of that? I mean, you've seen some states' lawmakers resisting these impulses more than others. I mean, for example, in Virginia and North Carolina, collective bargaining is still prohibited in the public sector. So what differences have you seen in states where this coalition has really come to power and others where it's been able to be held off?
Well, clearly in the states that have the highest level of public sector unionization, and among those are New York, which is number one, New Jersey, which is two or three, Connecticut, which is two or three, Illinois, California, we do see tremendous pressure in terms of unfunded pension liabilities, long-term other kinds of health care liabilities. We also see states that are, ironically, among the richest in the country in terms of household income, yet states that are unable to pay their bills, states in which, California being an example, which used to invest in things like infrastructure to the tune of 10 to 12% of its budget, but now you find things like public employee pension costs and compensation costs too, wages, as well as programs touted by the social advocates, most especially Medicaid, crowding out that kind of spending so that you have even rich states which aren't really investing in their future and can't pay their bills. Illinois is another good example of that. Connecticut, perhaps the richest state in the country, which keeps borrowing money to put into its pension system because it can't afford the benefits that is given to public employees out of tax revenues. As we saw in the housing crisis, borrowing for that kind of everyday activity doesn't eventually you end up destroying your own balance sheet, whether it's your personal balance sheet or your government's balance sheet.
So it's been a tumultuous few years in politics, both at the federal level, obviously, the Obama administration's been very active, but then also at the state and local level, you've had these very severe budget crises that have put pressure on all these programs. How have these forces changed, and how successful have the public employee unions and the other members of this coalition been at protecting their interests at a time when all of government is really under financial pressure?
Well, I would say that at the state level and the city level, they were not in a very good position to protect their interests because states are not technically allowed to run deficits, and nor are cities. However, something significant happened in 2008, and that is with the election of President Obama, you had someone who actually came up through this coalition and was elected by tremendous input and assistance from this coalition, who as president and with a Congress that was aligned with him has essentially set a federal agenda which has been dedicated to, in at least a certain part, to allowing the states to continue paying these bills through federal stimulus money that preserved the state and local jobs, that also had preserved some of the benefits that state and local benefits, and done a whole bunch of things that I think previously would have been somewhat unimaginable from Washington. And in fact, I would say one of the reasons we wanted to publish this book now on a subject that I've been writing about for 15 years or so is because really with the 2008 elections, you could say that we saw the big government coalition, which has been so important at the state and local level, gain traction federally, so that there are parts of the federal agenda that you can now say are, or have been at least for the last 2 years, manifestations of this big government coalition that's been gathering power for so many years.
So what do you think can be done about this? What can be done to take back governments and make spending priorities more reasonable, driven by the public interest?
Well, there's really a whole bunch of things that have to be done. And I think what people have to understand is it's more than just something like, oh, let's cut taxes or cut spending. We periodically have tax revolts in this country, and they often are grassroots efforts that begin at the state and local level. We had them in the late 1970s. Had them in the early 1990s. But what tends to happen is we cut taxes and maybe we put in place something like a taxpayer bill of rights, and then the taxpayer groups all sort of go away. But this coalition is permanent, and they begin clawing back a lot of those reforms. So one is, it isn't just about cutting taxes. It is about structural changes to government that differ from state to state. What's been going on, sometimes in back rooms or in political deals that are attached to bills which taxpayer groups and even the media didn't necessarily understand, is we've seen changes to things like the arbitration process around the country, where in some states you see the process is kind of loaded in favor of a union, so the contracts come to be favorable even when you have politicians who are trying to sort of hold the line. You look at a guy like Chris Christie in New Jersey, and he isn't just trying to fix the state's budget. He has a toolkit of all these 33 reforms, which include changes to civil service. And so there are structural reforms that are needed too. Finally, though, I think the thing that's needed is taxpayers have to figure out a way to become a permanent presence in a lot of places, because it's pretty clear that the state and local level in some states, neither party actually represents the taxpayers. And so as I do talk to taxpayer groups, you know, I see the taxpayer groups trying to transform themselves into something different, almost like a third political party that can watch both of the other parties. So you see some groups which are, for instance, making themselves into like membership organizations where they charge people $35 a year or $50 a year to be a member. And the idea is that there's someone who's watching, because the problem at the state and local level is that sometimes there's not two parties but one party, which I call the incumbency party. That when you have a very strong special interest who can threaten an incumbent of either party, you need a countervailing force, and the parties aren't always that countervailing force. So we'll see whether in this era of reform we get something more than just spending cuts. We see if we actually get the kind of structural reform that lasts over time. But I think in some way or another, taxpayers have to find a way to make themselves a more permanent presence. And that, I think, is probably the overarching message.
Sounds like there's a lot of work ahead. Well, thanks for being with us, Steve. Again, the book is called Shakedown, The Continuing Conspiracy Against the American Taxpayer. Thanks a lot.